for Satipatthana, subsection for Noble Truths. I thought to spend the last 2 days honing in a little bit more on the third Noble Truth of the cessation of suffering, and to just do a few readings around the subject of cessation, Nibbana, because there's a good reason for doing this. And the reason is because if you don't know where you are going, you will wind up somewhere else. One of Lungpa's favorite quotes from Yogi Berra. So I thought first just to... I thought Bhikkhu Bodhi had kind of a nice... summary, in a way, in his anthology, in the Buddha's words. So I thought I'd read that and then read a few passages from the suttas themselves. The goal of wisdom. The Four Noble Truths not only serve as the objective domain of wisdom, but also define its purpose, which is enshrined in the Third Noble Truth, the cessation of suffering. The cessation of suffering is Nibbana, and thus the goal of wisdom, the end toward which the cultivation of wisdom moves, is the attainment of Nibbana. But what exactly is meant by Nibbana? The suttas explain Nibbana in a number of ways. Some define Nibbana simply as the destruction of lust, hatred, and delusion. Others employ metaphors and images to convey a more concrete idea of the ultimate goal. Nibbana is still the destruction of lust, hatred, and delusion, but as such, it is, among other things, peaceful, deathless, sublime, wonderful, and amazing. Such descriptions indicate that Nibbana is a state of supreme happiness, peace, and freedom to be experienced in this present life. A few suttas, most notably a pair in the Udana, suggests that Nibbana is not simply the destruction of defilements and an exalted feeling of psychological well-being. They speak of Nibbana almost as if it were a transcendent state or dimension of being. Text 953 refers to Nibbana as a base, ayatana, beyond the world of common experience where none of the physical elements or even the subtle formless dimensions of experience are present. It is a state completely quiescent, without arising, perishing, or change. Another text calls it the state that is, quote, unborn, unmade, unbecome, and unconditioned, the existence of which makes possible deliverance from all that is born, made, come to be, and conditioned. How are we to correlate these two perspectives on Nibbana found in the Nikayas, one treating it as an experiential state of inward purity and sublime bliss, the other as an unconditioned state transcending the empirical world? Commentators, both Buddhists and outsiders, have tried to connect these two aspects of Nibbana in different ways. Their interpretations generally reflect the proclivity of the interpreter as much as they do the texts themselves. The way that seems most faithful to both aspects of Nibbana delineated in the texts is to regard the attainment of Nibbana as a state of freedom and happiness attained by realizing, with profound wisdom, the unconditioned and transcendent element, the state that is intrinsically tranquil and forever beyond suffering. The penetration of this element brings the destruction of defilements, culminating in complete purification of mind. Such purification is accompanied by the experience of perfect peace and happiness in this present life. With the breakup of the body at physical death, it becomes irreversible release from the beginningless round of rebirths. The suttas speak of two elements of Nibbana, the Nibbana element with residue remaining and the Nibbana element without residue remaining. The text explained the Nibbana element with residue remaining to be the destruction of lust, hatred, and delusion attained by an arahant while still alive. The quote-unquote residue that remains is the composite of the five aggregates that was brought into being by the ignorance and craving of the past life and that must continue on until the end of the lifespan. As to the Nibbana element without residue remaining, the same text says only that when the Arahant passes away, all that is felt, not being delighted in, will become cool right here. Since there is no more clinging to the five aggregates and no more craving for fresh experience through a new set of aggregates, the occurrence of the aggregates comes to an end and cannot continue. The process of the five aggregates is, quote unquote, extinguished, the literal meaning of Nibbana. The Buddha says nothing at all, however, in terms either of existence or non-existence, about the condition of the Arahant after death. It might seem logical to suppose that since the five aggregates that constitute experience completely cease with the attainment of Nibbana element without residue, this element must itself be a state of complete non-existence, a state of nothingness. Yet, no text in the Nikayas ever state this. To the contrary, the Nikayas consistently refer to Nibbana by terms that refer to actualities. It is an element, dhatu, a base, ayatana, a reality, dhamma, a state, pada, and so on. However, though so designated, it is qualified in ways that indicate this state ultimately lies beyond all familiar categories and concepts. In the text, the wanderer Vacchagota asked the Buddha whether the Tathagata, here signifying one who has attained the supreme goal, is reborn or not after death. The Buddha refuses to concede any of the four alternatives. To say that the Tathagata is reborn, is not reborn, both is and is not reborn, neither is nor is not reborn, none of these is acceptable. For all accept the term Tathagata as indicative of a real being. While from an internal point of view, a Tathagata has given up all clinging to notions of a real being. The Buddha illustrates this point with the simile of an extinguished fire. Just as a fire that has been extinguished cannot be said to have gone anywhere, but must simply be said to have gone out, so with the breakup of the body, the Tathagata does not go anywhere, but has simply gone out. The past participle, nibbutta, used to describe a fire that has been extinguished, is related to the noun nibbana, which literally means extinguishing. Yet if this simile suggests a Buddhist version of the annihilationist view of the Arahant's fate after his demise, this impression would rest on a misunderstanding, on a wrong perception of the Arahant as a self or person that is annihilated. Our problem in understanding the state of the Tathagata after death is compounded by our difficulty in understanding the state of the Tathagata even while alive. The simile of the great ocean underscores this difficulty. Since the Tathagata no longer identifies with the five aggregates that constitute individual identity, he cannot be reckoned in terms of them, whether individually or collectively. Freed from reckoning in terms of the five aggregates, the Tathagata transcends our understanding. Like the great ocean, he is deep, immeasurable, and hard to fathom. Now from the suttas. This one is from Samyutta 43, numbers 1 through 44 combined. 33 synonyms for Nibbana. Monks, I will teach you the unconditioned and the path leading to the unconditioned. Listen. And what, monks, is the unconditioned? The destruction of lust, the destruction of hatred, the destruction of delusion. This is called the unconditioned. And what, monks, is the path leading to the unconditioned? Mindfulness directed to the body. This is called the path leading to the unconditioned. Monks, I will teach you the uninclined, the taintless, the truth, the far shore, the subtle, the very difficult to see, the unaging, the stable, the undisintegrating, the unmanifest, the unproliferated, the peaceful, the deathless, the sublime, the auspicious, the secure, the destruction of craving, the wonderful, the amazing, the unailing state, Nibbana, the unafflicted, dispassion, purity, freedom, non-attachment, the island, the shelter, the asylum, the refuge, the destination, and the path leading to the destination. And what, monks, is the destination? The destruction of lust, the destruction of hatred, the destruction of delusion. This is called the destination. And what, monks, is the path leading to the destination? Mindfulness directed to the body. This is called the path leading to the destination. Thus, monks, I have taught you the unconditioned, etc., through the destination and the path leading to the destination. Whatever should be done, monks, by a compassionate teacher out of compassion for his disciples, desiring their welfare, that I have done for you. There are the roots of trees, monks. These are empty huts. Meditate, monks. Do not be negligent, lest you regret it later. This is my instruction to you. And then from the Udana, 8.1.
Question. Can you repack this mindfulness of the body? Do you think it's just a short course of mindfulness of, like all the satipatthanas?
Well, my sense is that, for whatever particular reason at that time, he wanted to emphasize that as there's many places in the suttas where he kind of says people who don't fully develop mindfulness of the body can't expect to reach the culmination of the path. So he's emphasizing it here, but I'm not saying that I wouldn't think that he's calling it exclusive or, the only way or anything like that. It's just, my sense is that he's just emphasizing.
When it comes up in meditations, it just comes back to directing attention to the body.
Okay. So, from the Udana. Thus have I heard. At one time, the Blessed One was dwelling at Sawati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. Now on that occasion, the Blessed One was instructing, rousing, inspiring, and gladdening the monks with the Dhamma talk connected with Nibbana. And those monks were receptive and attentive, concentrating their whole mind, intent on listening to the Dhamma. Then, on realizing its significance, the Blessed One on that occasion uttered this inspired utterance. There is, monks, that base where there is neither earth, nor water, nor heat, nor air. Neither the base of the infinity of space, nor the base of the infinity of consciousness, nor the base of nothingness, nor the base of neither perception nor non-perception, neither this world nor another world, neither sun nor moon. Here, monks, I say there is no coming, no going, no standing still, no passing away, and no being reborn. It is not established, not moving, without support. Just this is the end of suffering. And another one from the Udana, 8.3. Thus have I heard. At one time the Blessed One was dwelling at Sawati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. Now on that occasion the Blessed One was instructing the monks with a Dhamma talk connected with Nibbana, and those monks were receptive, intent on listening to the Dhamma. Then, on realizing its significance, the Blessed One on that occasion uttered this inspired utterance. There is, monks, an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned. If, monks, there were no unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, no escape would be discerned from what is born, become, made, conditioned. But because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, therefore an escape is discerned from what is born, become, made, conditioned. Okay, there's no other comments or thoughts. I thought I'd read as the final... text, go to the island, the book by Lumpa Pasano and Ajahn Amaro. and the last chapter, What Bliss, The Blessings of Nibbana. Let's get through probably the first third of it for the rest of today and then finish it up tomorrow. Begins with a quote from the Anguttara, 1.17.10. Monks, in one of right view, all deeds whatsoever of body done according to that view, all deeds whatsoever of speech, thought, all intentions, aspirations, and resolves, all activities whatsoever, all such things conduce to the pleasant, the dear and delightful, the profitable, in short, to happiness. What is the cause of that? Monks, it is because of their fortunate view. Suppose, monks, a seed of sugar cane, or paddy, or grape, be planted in moist soil. Whatsoever essence it derives from earth or water, all that conduces to its sweetness, pleasantness, and delicious flavor. What is the cause of that? The fortunate nature of the seed. Just so, monks, in one of right view, all deeds whatsoever conduce to happiness. What is the cause of that? It is because of their fortunate view. As we reach this last chapter, it may be noted that the overall structure of this book has been arranged according to seed, terrain, and fruition. The seed refers to basic definitions of Nibbana. The terrain is pointing to its description and characteristics. The last section on cultivation and fruition takes up the theme of the practice and its results. Just as in nature, a seed that has been planted in the ground and nourished properly will grow, flourish, and come to its fruition, in the same way we can plant the fortunate seeds of true knowledge and understanding in the ground of correct practice and living. The results of fruition are then reaped as liberation and freedom of the heart, the most noble goal for human beings to set for themselves. When a plant brings forth good and sweet fruit, it can bring satisfaction and sustenance for us and for others as well. Similarly, Nibbana is the sweetest and most nourishing of spiritual fruits, something that brings true happiness to the person who realizes it, as well as to the world. Although on a certain level, Nibbana is beyond all categorization, either positive or negative, the mind still needs something positive to inspire or motivate it. The Buddha recognized this in his teachings on the four Iddhipada, the four paths to accomplishment, sometimes translated as the four bases for success. This is one of the groups of dhammas in the 37 Bodhipakya dhammas, the qualities conducive to enlightenment. The first factor is chanda, which is aspiration, desire, or motivation. Nibbana is as it is, and the practitioner's task is to arouse the motivation to make the effort to realize Nibbana for him or herself. In this last short chapter, we will consider some of the positive aspects of Nibbana that can inspire faith as a condition for motivation and effort, thus laying the basis for realizing Nibbana and bringing blessings into the world. Having faith and confidence in something naturally draws us to it. When we have no faith or confidence, there is little or no sense of attraction. Sometimes people shrink back from Nibbana, viewing it as a source of loss or a blankness, and so feel little faith or confidence in it. This point is mentioned in the biography of Ajahn Mun. And then this is a quote from Venerable Acharya Mun Buridatta Thera, a spiritual biography by Ajahn Mahabua. The trouble is, most people react to talk about Nibbana by feeling oddly dejected and dismayed. It doesn't put them in a good mood, as does talk about worldly matters. Having no personal experience of Nibbana, they probably think that it's not as enjoyable as the humdrum things they are accustomed to. Not only has the present generation lost interest in Nibbana, even our parents and grandparents were not much interested, nor did they encourage others to take an interest. At most, they may have encouraged their family to do meditation practice to calm them down a bit and keep their behavior within acceptable limits. Of course, one way or another, they did manage to advise their family and friends to do just about everything else, until fed up with hearing their advice, most people no longer bothered to take it. Undoubtedly, most people have already decided that Nibbana must be a very silent place, there being no music or entertainment, and no one to indulge them in their favorite pastimes. They probably see it as a place devoid of anything stimulating or exciting, and therefore they don't want to go there. They fear dropping into a still, silent hell without a soul in sight. There would be no family, no friends, and no sounds ever of birds and cars or laughter and crying. It appears to be a rather bleak, undesirable place in every way. Similar attitudes toward Nibbana were present in the Buddha's time. This is from Majjhima 22. He thinks thus, "So I shall be annihilated, so I shall perish, so I shall be no more." Then he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. The Buddha points out that progress on the path is blocked if one cannot see the positive aspects of one's goal. This is from Anguttara 6. "Truly, O monks, that a monk who considers Nibbana as suffering can have a conviction that conforms with the Dhamma, that cannot be. And that one who has not entered into the certainty of rightness should realize the fruits of stream entry once returning, non-returning, or arahantship, that too cannot be." To recognize and reflect on the blessings that accrue to those who have contact with one who has realized Nibbana is one way to highlight the positive element of Nibbana. The experience of Nibbana is not something that leaves beings diminished. Instead, it leaves them enriched and brings blessings to others. In the next example, the Buddha points out that for those people who make offerings to the wanderer Sacchika, there would be a difference in the merits and blessings arising from their gifts, as opposed to offering to the Buddha, who was a purified being. The blessings that arise from offerings differ according to the recipient's degree of virtuous development and freedom from defilement. On this occasion, Sacchika had invited his followers to help in preparing and offering the meal to the Buddha along with the Sangha at his abode. This is from Majjhima 35. "Then, it being morning, the Blessed One dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, he went with the Sangha of Bhikkhus to the park of Sacchika the Niganta's son, and sat down on the seat made ready. Then, with his own hands, Sacchika the Niganta's son served and satisfied the Sangha of Bhikkhus headed by the Buddha with the various kinds of good food. When the Blessed One had eaten and had withdrawn his hand from the bowl, Sacchika, the Niganta's son, took a low seat, sat down at one side, and said to the Blessed One, 'Master Gotama, may the merit and the great meritorious fruits of this act of giving be for the happiness of the givers.' Agiwesana, whatever comes about from giving to a recipient such as yourself, one who is not free from lust, not free from hate, not free from delusion, that will be for the givers. And whatever comes about from giving to a recipient such as myself, one who is free from lust, free from hate, free from delusion, that will be for you.' The Buddha was very aware of the effect of generosity and of the merit generated for the donors when the recipients of their gifts are a well-practiced sangha. Hence, in the following sutta, the Buddha encourages the monks to practice diligently in order to attain Nibbana, so as to increase the blessings that accrue to people who give gifts of the requisites. Thus we can see that the motivation encouraged for following the path to arahantship is unselfish and compassionate. This tends to increase the blessings that arise for everyone's benefits. From Majjhima 39. "Recluses, recluses, bhikkhus, that is how people perceive you. And when you are asked, 'What are you?' you claim that you are recluses. Since that is what you are designated and what you claim to be, you should train thus. We will undertake and practice those things that make one a recluse, that make one a Brahmin, so that our designations may be true and our claims genuine, and so that the services of those whose robes, alms food, resting place, and medicinal requisites we use shall bring them great fruit and benefit, and so that our going forth shall not be in vain, but fruitful and fertile." Another aspect of the blessings generated for others is the delight beings find when coming into contact with one who has realized Nibbana. Whether the contact is direct or indirect, Whether those who make the contact are in the human realm or a celestial realm, the effect of one who has completely liberated the heart is tangible. And this is from Majjhima 31. After they had accompanied the Blessed One a little way and turned back again, the Venerable Nandiya and the Venerable Kimbila asked the Venerable Aniruddha, "Have we ever reported to the Venerable Aniruddha that we have obtained those abidings and attainments that the Venerable Aniruddha, in the Blessed One's presence, ascribed to us up to the destruction of the taints?" "The Venerable Ones have never reported to me that they have obtained those abidings and attainments. Yet by encompassing the Venerable Ones with my own mind, one's minds with my own mind, I know that they have obtained those abidings and attainments. And deities have also reported to me, these Venerable Ones have obtained those abidings and attainments." Then I declared it when directly questioned by the Blessed One. Then the spirit Diga Parajana went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to the Blessed One, he stood at one side and said, "It is a gain for the Vajjayans, Venerable Sir, a great gain for the Vajjayan people, that the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, dwells among them, and that these three clansmen, the Venerable Aniruddha, the Venerable Nandiya, and the Venerable Kimbila." On hearing the exclamation of the spirit, Diga Parajana, the earth gods exclaimed, It is a gain for the Vajjayans, a great gain for the Vajjayan people, that the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, dwells among them, and these three clansmen, the Venerable Aniruddha, Venerable Nandiya, and the Venerable Kimbila. On hearing the exclamation of the earth gods, the gods of the heaven of the four great kings, the gods of the heaven of the 33, the Yama gods, the gods of the Tusita heaven, the gods who delight in creating, the gods who wield power over others' creations, the gods of Brahma's retinue exclaimed, "It is a gain for the Vajjayans, a great gain for the Vajjayan people, that the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, dwells among them, and these three clansmen, the Venerable Aniruddha, the Venerable Nandiya, and the Venerable Kimbila." Thus at that instant, at that moment, those Venerable Ones were known as far as the Brahma world. I think I'll leave it there for this evening. A few passages to give one a positive sense of where this practice can ultimately lead.
I'm not sure if there's any... here's a question. When somebody offers food, let's say they offer food to the monks, is the merit they get dependent upon the attainment of that individual at that point? Or, let's say that individual ends up being highly attended later, does that merit still reflect back on that person? Does that person, in effect, get credit?
Right.
It's like, is it an ongoing thing?
Right. I have no idea, but I'm sure that Lungpa has an opinion.
Well, of course, it's not totally black and white, absolutely clear. Because one, it depends on both the intention and kind of the values of the person who gives, and their particular state of mind, their particular values that they have. So if they have faith, then that usually uplifts the mind. Generally, it's dependent on the actual state of mind of that person, that is the recipient of the offering at that time. But there is also what comes to mind is the logic that Visakha gave to the Buddha when she asked for permission to make special offerings to the monks and nuns at Savatthi for food for when they're sick, for food to when they're traveling, for rain cloths and And one of the reasons that she gave was that after she had offered those things, and then hearing at some point in the future that particular monk or nun had realized that she would be able to get great delight from that offering, so that that has a has an effect. It's just very practical. You think of somebody makes an offering, and then they hear that person has had some particular spiritual insight, and it's a source of how I help them out. Really, as opposed to having made offerings to somebody and then find out that some sort of scandal is happening. It gives a different feeling.
And then I think he further asked her, or she further said that, and that the happy mind is the one that becomes easily concentrated.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that makes a lot of sense what you said.
For her own benefit.
So if she constantly is recollecting that as that person, has further attainments.
Is there someone in the sutras where there's a four man and woman woman has a child, and they were working before, and now they can't afford food, so she sends this yogi, pretend to be an ascetic, and the king will possibly feed you, and if he sees you, and then that happens, but then the king has a little bit of doubt and sends his servants out. So that's not familiar at all. To see if he's really an arhat, and the servants end up lying to him, and say, yeah, he is an arhat, he disappeared, he just moved in there. And he's like, oh, great, he's more on the question is, around merit. What is that?
Sounds like the Shaggy Dog story.
But it's
like
But it's an interesting conundrum. Not something bothered. But that's not something you've heard from the
I've never heard it. Even from anywhere else.